because the trade bloc would want to maintain access to the U.S. market because it's such a big, rich market.
Increasingly, there are a number of countries that are targets of U.S. sanctions. Iran, one of them, along with China and Russia, just to name a few here. For the U.S. dollar has caused damages being used as the currency for international transactions, but that is increasingly becoming a target for elimination. One of these methods is to conclude bilateral or multilateral monetary treaties using the local currencies and eliminating the dollar as a consequence. So far, you have roughly about 50 countries that have signed bilateral currency treaties among themselves, eliminating the U.S. dollar from their exchanges. Additionally, creating and replacing the SWIFT financial system with an alternative one can help with stopping the U.S. sanctions effect. Russia actually has launched a messaging system. It's called SPFS, and China is looking at switching from SWIFT to cross-border interbank payment system, or CIPS, due to these U.S. sanctions. Okay, Ian Williams and Robert Bruska, rejoin us here. I first got to go to you, Ian. We are back to the dollar issue. How pivotal a role does this play when it comes to trade? Can countries or countries within a trading bloc trade amongst others as to stop the U.S. hegemony when it comes to world trade and economy vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar?
Then the other trading blocs are not going to work. In Latin America, they have trading blocs. They have Mercosur. They have agreements between Brazil and Argentina. They trade in dollars.
All right, Ian was to the point. Robert, let me come to you. There's an exception here, however. We have countries that do trade without the dollar who are under sanctions, like Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela. These are countries that conduct trade, like Iran, for example, who delivered to Lebanon and Venezuela with oil and gas. So there are exceptions to the rule, aren't there?
Of course, these are countries that the United States has a lot of political differences with and has for quite some time. And, you know, there's a recent schism with Venezuela. Venezuela used to be a country that the U.S. did a lot of trade with. And, of course, Venezuela has oil, but it has, you know, this heavy, what they call heavy sour oil, the Orinoco grade, that has been a little bit less advantage. And, of course, the other problem with Venezuela is it's allowed its oil facilities to deteriorate quite substantially. And so when you look at these countries, that are not countries that have an awful lot to offer the U.S. in terms of trade. The U.S. has had this lack of trade with Cuba for quite a long time for political reasons. And so I don't think you have a list of countries there that put the United States at any kind of an economic disadvantage. In fact, these are countries that the U.S. has long-standing political difficulties with, and they need to have more of a political agreement before they're going to even be able to think of having a closer economic agreement.
Why do trade agreements collapse? In theory, the signing of a deal which can boost an economy should be a win-win situation for all parties concerned. Yet, when we take a look back at trade agreements of the past, and even ones that are still in play, one of the major challenges in maintaining an agreement are the political differences between nations. Take, for example, the case of the EU. The varying cultures and political views in Europe is as wide as a spectrum can allow. And hence, this is why the UK, for example, broke away from the EU. Yet, as we all know and have seen, the devastating economic cost of Britain appears to be far greater than the benefits of leaving the bloc over political differences. The same can be said of the NAFTA agreement, which saw Trump pull out, citing a bad deal. This is another example of how differences in political thought have changed the shape of the trade deals that were actually quite successfully in place. But the U.S., by pulling out of trade deals, has seen itself be isolated on the world stage. The RCEP is one example, again, an agreement that has been criticized that it will more likely benefit China more than other signatory members. However, with China being the economic powerhouse behind the agreement, it seems that China in particular has a lot to gain by having 14 other free trade partners at its disposal in the RCEP. The economic expansion sought by China and demonstrated through the likes of the One Belt, One Road initiative are clear examples of how China is using trade to expand its footprints around the world. And as we deal with trade wars, COVID-19, and economic uncertainty, the RCEP, again, an example of China's multilateral adaptability to its economic roadmap.
Well, I think, speaking of China, we need to think about, we need to put this against the general background of Chinese economic strategy. China has been promoting very hard its very ambitious One Belt and One Road project across the globe. And it comes at a very interesting time. We are now in the middle of a global pandemic. We are also seeing an escalating tension in China and the U.S. and also some regional countries. So I think this is something that will be supplementing China's One Belt, One Road project.
The notion of multilateralism is a concept that should be embraced. Yet the world has started to see super trade deals emerging without the U.S. For example, the 25-year Iran-China cooperation agreement will see $400 billion or more in trade between the two countries. Meanwhile, Iran has also joined the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Council.
With the addition of new member countries, I think it will give countries in this region opportunity to bring together their efforts in order to more integrate their supply chain positions in the region, so that the countries will be more integrated from the point of view of a regional value chain. I think this will make a very positive impact on countries in this region compared to the existing ones.
My final thoughts, world trade is changing. Globalism is the preferred way, the old system that ruled the world finance, with protectionism abolished for the most part. Well, COVID-19 has changed regional dynamics, but not regional trade. And when it comes to the U.S., it is becoming evident that it will remain on the back foot, not only because of the pandemic, the economic contraction that it experienced, but also due to its trade war with China. There's also an increasing number of countries who want and don't mind doing trade without the U.S., especially ones that are under U.S. sanctions, who also would prefer not to trade in dollars as to not be restricted to U.S. hegemony. So far, roughly about 50 countries have signed bilateral currency treaties among themselves, eliminating the U.S. dollar from their exchanges. That is it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. From Mikove Tahle and the entire team, it's goodbye until next week.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday, 25th of October, filed a civil lawsuit against the House January 6th Committee in an effort to block the release of documents relating to his actions on that day. The article you're about to hear has been written by CBS News journalists Caroline Linton, Robert Lagar, and Zach Hudak. The piece is titled, Trump Sues House January 6th Committee to Block Release of Documents. Stay with us for more. Former U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday, 25th of October, filed a civil lawsuit against the House January 6th Committee in an effort to block the release of documents relating to his actions on that day. In the filing, Donald Trump referred to the committee's investigation as an illegal fishing expedition. President Biden last week rejected Donald Trump's assertion of executive privilege for the documents requested by the committee. And the White House said it would give the panel access to federal records connected to the Trump White House and the January 6th insurrection. The former president's clear objective is to stop the select committee from getting to the facts about January 6th, and his lawsuit is nothing more than an attempt to delay and obstruct our probe. Precedent and law are on our side. Representatives Liz Cheney and Benny Thompson, who chaired the January 6th committee, said in a statement on Monday night. The select committee's authority to seek these records is clear, the statement continued. We'll fight the former president's attempt to obstruct our investigation while we continue to push ahead successfully with our probe on a number of other fronts. The lawsuit comes on the eve of the committee's voting on whether to hold Donald Trump's senior advisor, Steve Bannon, in criminal contempt for defying a subpoena to appear. On Monday night, the committee released a resolution asking for Steve Bannon to be held in criminal contempt, saying documents and testimony for Bannon are critical to the Select Committee's investigation. If the committee votes in favor of holding Bannon in criminal contempt, the whole House will vote on it. If a majority of the House votes to do so, it will send a criminal contempt referral to the U.S. attorney. The resolution also said the reason Steve Bannon's lawyer has given for his failure to comply with the committee's subpoena, executive privilege, would not apply here and has not even been invoked via communication with the select committee. Donald Trump's lawsuit names the committee chair, Benny Thompson, the entire committee, the National Archives, and David Ferrero, the director of the National Archives. The lawsuit accuses the committee of sending an illegal, unfounded, and overboard records request to the National Archivist and says the records are protected by numerous legal privileges. The lawsuit cites several of the requests of the committee, including its request for all documents and communications relating to the prepared public remarks and actual public remarks of Donald Trump between 3rd of November 2020 and 20th of January 2021. Issued public statements are one thing, but the notion that Congress is somehow entitled to ask for and review any and all private conversations, remarks, or drafts of public statements considered by the President of the United States and his close advisors without limitations on, among other things, subject matter, would destroy the very fabric of our constitutional separation of powers and invade fundamental privileges designed to maintain the autonomy and functioning of the executive branch, the lawsuit says. The lawsuit also takes issue with the request for all documents and communications within the White House on 6th of January 2021 relating in any way to the President and the Vice President, over two dozen of the highest-ranking officials in the federal government and members of Congress. The lawsuit alleges the committee is no way entitled to these records. On 6th of January, Donald Trump spoke at Stop the Steal rally ahead of Congress convening to count the electoral votes, a largely ceremonial final step affirming Joe Biden's victory. Donald Trump encouraged his supporters to walk over to the Capitol to protest the results of the election. Chaos erupted at the Capitol a few hours later as thousands of Mr. Trump's supporters descended on the Capitol, breaking windows and ransacking the building. Lawmakers, including former Vice President Mike Pence, fled the floor amid the riot, which led to the deaths of five people and the arrests of hundreds more. Donald Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives 1 week later for inciting the riot, but was later acquitted by the Senate. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi created the House Select Committee earlier this year to establish the truth of what happened on that day. Despite the initial attempts to make it a bipartisan committee, Representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, two of the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump, are the only two Republicans on the nine-person committee. In addition to Steve Bannon, the committee has subpoenaed the organizers of the Stop the Steal rally, as well as former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Communications Director Dan Scavino, and Pentagon Chief of Staff Kashyap Patel.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Friday, Israel declared it has placed six prominent Palestinian human rights groups on the regime's so-called terrorist list. The targeted groups include key partners of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The six targeted human rights groups are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, Defense for Children Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bisson Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. Some of these rights groups have closely cooperated with the International Criminal Court in its probe into Israeli war crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to Palestinian media, the move will pave the way for Israel to effectively outlaw the activities of these civil society groups, raid their offices, seize their assets, arrest and jail their staff members, and even criminalize any public expressions of support for these groups. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has justified the blacklisting by accusing the right groups of having ties with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine resistance movement, alleging they have provided funding for anti-Israeli resistance groups. Israel's move to designate Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations is yet another example of its decades-long crackdown on political activism in the occupied territories. The move has sparked condemnations from inside and outside the occupied territories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh stated that the Palestinian organizations work with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shtayyeh called on world bodies to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. Also, the spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Azam Qasem said the move disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinian existence. Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq joined the chorus of condemnation as well.
First, this is clearly a political decision and the continuation of an Israeli campaign that has been taking place for more than a decade, targeting Palestinian organizations with the aim of silencing and frightening them in order to stop them from playing their primary role in defending Palestinians' rights.
Javarin also urged the countries which support Palestine to adopt a clearer position and take serious and a strong action on the issue. Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's decision as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. In addition, international rights groups condemned the move as an assault on civil society and expressed solidarity with the targeted organizations.
This is a very provocative escalation, but it is, I wouldn't say it's a new war because the war has been ongoing for years now, but it's clearly an attempt to defame, defund, and delegitimize some very, very important human rights organizations that do incredible work in Israel. I happen to have personally worked with all six, which says something, I guess.
Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any persecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes that has given Israel the audacity to time and again attempt to defame and sabotage the work of Palestinian human rights groups to end its impunity. The regime's latest move to blacklist six Palestinian human rights groups is yet another example of Israel's systematic and relentless campaign against Palestinian civil society organizations and leading human rights defenders. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has described Tel Aviv's declaration as characteristic of totalitarian regimes with the clear purpose of shutting down these organizations. In fact, this move threatens to shut down civil society groups that document human rights violations by Israel. They report human rights abuses against Palestinian children, advocate rights of the thousands of Palestinians held as political prisoners by Israel, and so forth.
Well, I think the Israeli government has long attempted to crush any information about their violations, about, you know, for instance, to the international courts, about all sorts of violent international law, and that this is a continuation of their policy of suppressing criticism of the occupation and the siege of Gaza.
Human rights defenders are not terrorists and should never be accused like this. Clearly, Israel intends to silence the violations that it is committing in the occupied territories by attacking the civil society organizations. Therefore, if not responded to swiftly and properly, this could give the green light to Tel Aviv that it can shamelessly continue its crimes against Palestinians.
The United States and China have in recent months escalated their war of words. This time, China says its sovereignty is at risk, cautioning the U.S. against sending the wrong signals.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman warned that his country has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including its territorial integrity. Wang also noted that Taipei is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the issue is purely China's internal affair, and that Beijing won't allow any external interference. It was responding to these comments U.S. President Joe Biden made during a CNN town hall Q&A.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment.
What the United States says, if the American president puts in the minds of China, of the Taiwanese independence activists and independence politicians, the idea that Taiwan could, for example, make a declaration of independence, China would act on that. And I don't know what the United States could, or on its own, on the terms of its own terms of China policy since the last 50 years, should do or could do to prevent China from acting on that.
The U.S. has recently deployed a fleet of B-1 bombers and 200 airmen to its notorious base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the first such deployment to the island in 15 years. The base at Diego Garcia has a dark history. The U.S. has used the base to launch airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's said to have been used as a black site to interrogate and torture victims of the CIA. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and has warned against any of its independence bids. Tensions escalated recently over Chinese military flights as well as increased U.S. military support for Taiwan. Just 2 weeks ago, U.S. media reported that American forces had been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all world countries recognize that sovereignty. The U.S., too, recognizes Chinese sovereignty over the island, but has long curtailed Taipei in an attempt to unnerve Beijing. The United States, which backs Taipei's separatist president, also continues to sell weapons to the island in defiance of Beijing and in violation of its own official policy.
What they call a strategic ambiguity in American policy. They like to keep Taiwan as in some kind of de facto independent status, but they have recognized de jure that it's one country and Taiwan is a part of China.
China has also denounced the recently clinched AUKUS pact between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the U.S., under which the trio is expected to make a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. Beijing argues that the pact threatens regional stability and poses nuclear proliferation risks. U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In case of China, however, it appears that he's following in the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing.
Abdulbari Atwan, a well-known author, has described the recent highlights in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon as an American Zionist conspiracy to ignite a civil war in the region. Atwan stated that the U.S. Zionist conspiracy to create a sectarian conflict in the region will fail. He said, sectarian conflicts have been created with the aim of securing Israel's interests and stealing Lebanese gas. But this sedition will not go ahead, and if it goes on, the U.S. and its allies will surely be defeated. In fact, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foil their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The U.S. has attempted to weaken the resistance axis by hatching different plots, such as causing instability and wars in the region for years. However, the resistance has always been ready to properly respond to these threats. For instance, Washington has always sought to keep Israel's enemies at one another's throat so that they could not give Israel trouble. But the resistance front has time and again proven that it will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity. as it has launched retaliatory attacks against Tel Aviv, which have exposed the vulnerability of the regime's entities in the region. Israel's constant violations of Lebanese airspace are also a source of instability. This has been seen as a constant provocation by Israel, mainly directed at the resistance movement Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the U.S. has also been accused of creating an atmosphere of instability. On the one hand, it has imposed sanctions on Lebanon, which prevents foreign investment in the country. It has even opposed the delivery of fuel shipments from Iran is in an emergency mode due to a lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador has stirred controversy by making anti-Hezbollah statements, so much so that a judge ordered a media ban on her. The trip by the number three diplomat at the State Department, Victoria Nolan, to Lebanon, also proved to be controversial. Her purpose was to meet government officials and representatives to discuss Lebanon's reforms and elections. The question that arises is, what does she have to do with Lebanon's elections? Nolan was famously accused of promoting regime change in Ukraine, backing the Maidan protesters and opposition, which showed how the Ukrainian opposition is being manipulated by Washington. Coincidentally, while she was there, the deadly protest in Lebanon erupted, which resulted in the death of several Lebanese. What is for certain is that the popularity of the resistance in the region will be a severe challenge for the enemies, who are hatching plots against them, specifically Israel and the U.S. The face-off between the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro and the opposition led by Juan Guaido has put Caracas in a years-long political impasse and economic crisis. Several rounds of talks in recent years have been futile, and the two sides have failed to reach a consensus. In August, the Venezuelan government and the opposition began a new round of negotiations in Mexico City aimed at overcoming Venezuela's political and economic crisis. The dialogue was mediated by Norway. However, the latest developments have hampered the process of a possible settlement. Venezuela's government has decided to suspend the talks after Cape Verde extradited a Venezuelan envoy named Alex Saab to the United States on money laundering charges on Saturday. Saab was arrested in Cape Verde under a U.S. arrest warrant in June 2020 when his plane stopped there to refuel. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro lashed out at the U.S. for what he called kidnapping of an envoy to face an American court.
Saab was taken yesterday, skirting over everything. A plane arrived, assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows from the jail he was held. They took him without advising lawyers, the family, nobody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
Jorge Rodriguez, who heads the government's negotiating team, described the government's decision as a deep expression of protest over the brutal aggression against Alex Saab. He also called on Washington to release Saab immediately.
Venezuela is alerting the world that the life of Alex Saab is in danger. It's in the hands of judicial system that is directed at harming Venezuela. And we demand his immediate release by the American government.
The U.S. charged Saab in 2019 in connection with a bribery scheme and sanctioned him for allegedly orchestrating a corruption network that allowed Caracas to profit from a state-run food subsidy program. However, Saab's lawyers have denied the U.S. charges as politically motivated.
This is absolutely a political attack on Venezuela, and it is a kidnapping. This shows just how far in lawlessness the United States is willing to go and how much they are determined to attack Venezuela.
Meanwhile, U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido reacted to the decision to suspend the talks, accusing the government of evading the nation's problems. Caracas aims to ease U.S.-led sanctions on the Venezuelan nation, while the opposition says it aims to use the talks to secure guarantees for regional elections to be held in the fall. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. Then, United States refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation, and froze millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in the U.S. bank account. Washington has been using sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro in what has been termed economic terrorism. Venezuela has faced chronic shortages of food and medicine as a result of U.S. sanctions, resulting in years of political and economic crisis.
Well, this is exactly what the U.S. government wants to prevent. And this may be also an effort on their part to sabotage even the negotiations going on in Mexico. That how can the talks continue under in this situation? But what needs to be condemned and denounced is depriving any country of food and medicine, particularly in this time of pandemic.
While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new, the U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but further complicate the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst a full-blown crisis.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. hurt my finger. It's, pain is killing me. What am I doing? I'm trying to hang a picture on the wall. Oh, well, this picture is painted by an old artist in Tabriz and is inherited to my grandma from her mother. My grandma also gave this picture to me as a birthday gift. I'm so happy to have this picture. I love paintings. You know, I think art in general elevates the human soul. Oh, well, today we are going to get familiar with one of the cultural and artistic centers of the Iranian capital. Yes, we are going to Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art. Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art was built in 1977. Internationally, this museum is known as TMOCA, which stands for Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art. Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art contains the most comprehensive and most important collections of modern art outside Europe and North America. This museum contains masterpieces of different art movements. Among them, mention can be made of abstract, expressionism, pop art, minimalism art, conceptual art, and photorealism. In the permanent collection of Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art, there are thousands of masterpieces of visual art of Iranian and world artists. Among them, 400 are invaluable. Also, among the distinctive works of this museum, mention can be made of the masterpieces by Paul Gauguin, Renoir, Picasso, René Magritte, Max Ernst, Jackson Pollock, and Andy Warhol. A very important collection of Iran's contemporary art and paintings by artists like Sohrab Sepehri are included in this museum. I am now in Lale Park, where Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art is located. There is a garden in the outside area of the museum, which has beautiful sculptures. Most of these sculptures are the pieces of great world artists. Oh, well, I'll make a complete report about the sculptures garden later. I am now standing by the building of the museum. This building is a combination of Iranian traditional and modern architecture. The architectural elements used in this building include vestibule, wind catcher, torso, and passage. This building is made of concrete and stone. The unique feature about this building is that the exterior view is inspired by the wind catchers of the marginal areas of Iran's desert. I am now inside the museum. This museum has 9 galleries. Well, now I'm walking on a spiral route which reaches the bottom part of the museum with a little slope. Now I am at the end of this slope, and you can't believe if I say what important masterpiece is in front of my eyes. Well, it's a masterpiece called Matter and Thought, or Oil Pool, by Noriyuki Haraguchi, Japanese artist. It's actually a shallow square welded steel container filled with black oil. Since the oil remains stable against water and has reflective properties, it is similar to a large mirror on the floor. Really beautiful. And on the other side of the museum, there is the exhibition of Andy Warhol works, which I'm going to visit. It's really exciting to be here. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Protecting press freedom. Supporters of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange marching all the way to the British Royal Courts of Justice today ahead of an upcoming extradition hearing. The starting point, the BBC headquarters.
One of the main issues that we have with Assange is that his extradition, the case which is being heard next week, the whole basis of the case, the facts about the case, most of this never gets anywhere near the British media.
The US government is attempting to extradite Assange under an old treaty with the UK for publishing damning documents of US war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and human rights violations elsewhere. His supporters say the charges are politically motivated.
It means basically that every journalist anywhere in the world has to be afraid of a possible extradition, especially if he is reporting on national security issues, not just by the United States or other Western countries, but by any country.
Just last month, it was revealed that in 2017, as Assange began his fifth year holdup in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the U.S. government plotted to kidnap or assassinate him on British soil. Still, the U.K. is carrying on with his trial.
It besmirches a reputation which at least the British establishment think they have got internationally. It's supposed to be a beacon of free speech. It's supposed to be a beacon of the free press. And while Julian Assange is in Belmarsh...
Since he was evicted from the Ecuadorian embassy 2 years ago, Assange has been languishing in a maximum security prison in southeast London. His next court hearing is set for October 27th and 28th. If extradited, he'll face 175 years in a U.S. prison.
It'll be a watershed moment in the most important press freedom case of the century. And these protesters say they're hoping that the U.K. government and justice system will do the right thing and put an end to what they describe as the show trial of Julian Assange. Saeed Pereza, London.
press conference held by the Sudanese pro-civilian rule factions, the Force of Freedom and Change factions, FFC has categorically rejected any move to dissolve the government without consent of the factions and Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. Meanwhile, an unarmed group stormed the building of the Sudan news agency SUNA and used physical and verbal violence to terrorize journalists and media professions in attempt to prevent the convening of the conference, which had been announced earlier by FFC.
We in the Forces of Freedom and Change affirm our continuous support for Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and his government, who were chosen by the FFC to lead the transition in Sudan, and we reaffirm our full support and coordination with him.
Sudan has been grappling with the biggest political crisis in its 2 years old transition. The military and civilian groups have been sharing power in troubled alliance since long-standing President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in 2019. Observer believes that the only way out for Sudan's current crisis through expanding base of participation and unification of revolutionary forces.
I assure that there is no way out of this crisis without expanding the base of participation and rearranging the internal conditions of the forces of the Sudanese revolution as the guarantor of any real transformation in the political scene.
On the other hand, protesters from the splinter FFC faction, the National Charter Alliance, have been holding a sit-in outside Khartoum's presidential palace for the seventh day, with soldiers around the site providing protection. Time is running out for all government components without reaching a solution for the political crisis, while FCC rejects all the mediation and solution made by the military before handing over the power to the civilian next month. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
A new poll shows that 3 out of every 4 French people believes that their purchasing power has diminished due to rising inflation, and 90% of the nation is worried about it. The nation's economy minister departed from his Western peers by admitting that inflation will continue to rise until 2023 at the earliest. Combined with unemployment, which was entrenched even before the coronavirus recession, the admission seems to announce the beginning of dreaded stagflation.
La vie est chère et encore plus à Paris.
Life is expensive, especially in Paris, from real estate to basic shopping needs to even the price of a simple lunch. Our purchasing power keeps going down.
The government has just announced a cap on household gas prices until the end of 2022. Natural gas has soared to record highs across Europe. They also announced a one-time payment of 100 euros to those who earn less than 2,000 euros per month, which amounts to 60% of the population. However, many say the one-off payment is not nearly enough.
Ça devient compliqué, ça diminue fortement.
No, it's not enough at all. When somebody is only taking home 2,000 euros a month, 100 euros isn't nearly enough to make difference when it comes to the energy costs. The government is not helping the middle class much at all.
The Yellow Vest protests, which initially kicked off 3 years ago due to rising fuel prices, just began what they called Season 2 last weekend. They are promising to continue marching. By a huge margin, purchasing power is the number one issue ahead of France's presidential election next year, just as it has been in all the elections since the great financial crisis began.
It's really fragile right now. The middle class just isn't seeing a fair relationship between their work and the amount they are paid.
Inflation is being reported seemingly worldwide, as the coronavirus lockdowns may have created a monetary monster. Many economists say the only solutions are controls on prices, as well as corporate profits, and higher wages, which have remained stagnant across the West for decades. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
This was the first face-to-face meeting of EU leaders since the bloc's energy crisis really came to the fore. Millions of citizens simply don't have the money to pay for electricity and gas bills, which have skyrocketed since the start of the year.
We will intensify our outreach to the different suppliers, also to diversify the supply we do have, and we have to speed up the work on interconnections.
Experts say Iran, with its enormous oil and gas reserves, is an obvious option for the EU. Illegal US sanctions are hampering exports, but that will change if the Iran nuclear deal is revived.
The real game changers will be if Iran comes into international market with full force, increasing its oil exports, increasing its gas production.
It has been confirmed that during their summit on Thursday and Friday, EU leaders debated erecting barbed wire along the bloc's external border to manage the refugee crisis, made worse by the situation in Afghanistan. Ursula von der Leyen says the idea is out of the question. On the subject of COVID-19, the EU has failed to convince citizens in some countries to take the vaccine. For example, the virus is now out of control in Romania and Bulgaria.
Some difficulties that are related to the vaccination hesitancy, and it's why it's also important to cooperate, to coordinate, in order to make also progress on this challenge.
Some EU nations want funding cut to Poland over alleged rule of law breaches. Right-wing leaders, such as Hungary's Viktor Orban, are dead against the move, though.
There is no need to have any sanction. It's ridiculous.
Germany's Angela Merkel, who gave her last press conference at an EU leaders summit before leaving office, says she's also opposed to legal action against Warsaw. Apart from not meeting the needs of citizens and in turn allowing populism to take hold, critics say another key reason the EU is facing rule of law issues is because those running the project have been too eager to expand at all costs to create a superstate, and in the process have allowed countries to join that do not share EU values. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A spectre is haunting America. The spectre, Striketober. Upwards of 100,000 workers across the U.S. are either currently on strike or potentially just weeks away from it, amid a historic wave of labor actions that's taken the country by storm. 35,000 nurses and healthcare workers have voted to authorize a strike against healthcare giant Kaiser Permanente. 60,000 Hollywood crew members seem headed for a strike amid widespread rank-and-file disapproval of a deal negotiated by union management. And thousands of workers elsewhere have already walked off.
Last week, 10,000 UAW members in warehouse and production jobs at John Deere started currently what is the biggest strike happening in the country. We have 2,000 TWA nurses in Buffalo and 1,400 Kellogg workers. They're also out on strike. About 1,000 mine workers in Alabama have been on strike at Warrior Met Coal since this past April.
These are just some of over a dozen labor actions brewing across the country. As executives have seen profits soar amid the COVID-19 pandemic, workers are insisting on their own piece of the pie. And with supply chain issues plaguing distribution and now hiring signs popping up left and right, they're wielding historic leverage to secure the raises and benefits they say management has been withholding for too long.
There is a tight labor market. Workers are fed up with being mistreated. We have, the most pro-union president ever, potentially even more than FDR. We have a union leader at the Department of Labor who is heading the Department of Labor. Positive union sentiment in polls are the highest it's been in a very long time. Labor has a lot of leverage, and this critical moment is not going to last forever.
With the wind at their backs, many workers say it's time to press their advantage and lock in the wage increases and workplace improvements that have been steadily eroded by decades of neoliberal governance and attacks on organized labor. And with no real sense for just how long this window of opportunity will last, they say it's time to strike while the iron is hot. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
Six years have passed since Iran and several states, namely the US, China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany, put their signatures to a deal under which Tehran agreed to limit some of its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. But in 2018, the situation reached a deadlock,